Welcome to the Long COVID podcast with me, Jackie Baxter. I am really excited to bring you today's episode. Please do check out the links in the show notes where you can find the podcast website, social media and support group, as well as a link to buy me a coffee if you are able. You should not rely on any medical information contained in this podcast and related materials in making medical, health-related or other decisions. Please do consult a doctor or other health professional. I love to hear from you. If you've got any suggestions or feedback or just want to say hey, then please do get in touch. I really hope you enjoy this episode, so here we go. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Long COVID podcast. I am delighted to be joined today by Nigel McCracken and Sean Knight. And we are going to be diving a little bit into the research world. And I'm going to let them introduce themselves. So a very, very warm welcome to the podcast today.
Hello, Jackie, and thank you very much. So this is Nigel McCracken. Just a wee bit of background about myself. I'm actually Scottish and live in Edinburgh at the moment. I sort of background in clinical pharmacology, and I've worked in drug development for the last 30 years and recently has taken up a role at Chief Operating Officer for a company called Virax Biolabs, who are actually interested in developing immune profiling solutions as well as T-cell diagnostics.
Hi, Jackie. So this is Sean Knight. I'm an academic clinician. I grew up a long way from Scotland. So I actually grew up in Africa. I'm an academic clinician. That means basically I spend half of my time doing research and half of my time looking after patients. And my clinical specialty is respiratory medicine. So that means looking after people who have lung diseases, including people who have infections and a whole, basically anything that's gone wrong with the lungs, really.
Perfect. We are kind of diving into the world of long COVID research. Is it too soon a question to ask, like, what brought you guys together? Or is that kind of further down the story?
Well, I can answer that one. So, as I said, I've been doing drug development for a long time and worked across many indications. And certainly over the last 15 years or so, I've been sort of heading up groups around translational medicine. So I've always been interested in understanding the immune component of a lot of diseases, and particularly infectious disease and oncology. So actually, in my previous job as Chief Scientific Officer, we were actually had a molecule that was targeting a specific target that for actually COVID, but as well as oncology, because it was actually targeting that microenvironment, and we'll go on to that a little bit, the importance of that. So from my own background, I did actually run a couple of COVID studies, and in doing so came across the University of Manchester, because we were doing an awful lot of research around that. It just so happened that the target that I was looking at reduced the interferon gamma levels, and we'll go into that around that, the general chronic inflammation part. And in doing so, I was introduced to Professor Tracy Hussle, who I know that Sean sort of works with. So rolling on to the next role, which was more around diagnostics and that early diagnosis, all these conditions and whatever, it was really quite nice. We reached out to Tracy, and then from Tracy, we got introduced to Sean, because Sean had actually this ongoing study that he was involved in. And I'll hand that over to Sean then.
Yeah. So it's been, in fact, like a lot of the COVID work I've been involved in, it's all been sort of fortuitous and chance encounters that have kind of led to these interactions happening and driving a lot of the research forward. So, much like Nigel in a way, sort of going further back, I was actually more interested in lung cancer and the immunology of lung cancer before the pandemic. So I'd actually, around sort of late 2019, early 2020, I'd taken time out of my clinical work to set up my laboratory with Tracy Hussle over at the Lydia Becker Institute in Manchester. And it's amazing in hindsight, when you go back through the dates, to see how quickly things changed with COVID and how it went from sort of an esoteric thing that was in the news to, rolling all the way out and realizing that it was going to have such a massive impact on everyone sort of around the world. So we were sort of very much in that whole sort of stage of disbelief, and then working out what we could do to, I guess, to use the resources from, you know, the research perspective that we had to try and help people with COVID. So Tracy and I, together with some other investigators in Manchester, set up this longitudinal COVID-19 study. And it had very broad objectives at the beginning, in the sense that at that stage, we knew nothing about the virus and how it affected the immune system. So what we planned to do was pretty much invite people to take part as they came into hospital with COVID-19. And many patients donated their blood for our research. And we basically looked at almost every immune cell, and we tried to work out what they were doing in acute COVID-19. So obviously that was before we knew what the natural sort of course of the infection would be. And certainly at that stage, we had no idea that long COVID was going to be, you know, such a prominent thing coming out the other side. So that study essentially evolved into a long COVID study, because a lot of those patients that we recruited when they came into hospital, we followed up after they left hospital, and they continued to donate samples for us. And I guess at that stage, the group started to separate out, in that some people made a full recovery, and then it became clear that some people weren't making a full recovery. And what was interesting about that was that it wasn't always driven by how severe their infection was. So that was the thing that sort of, I guess, stood out for me, really, is I'd met some people who were in intensive care with their COVID-19. And when we saw them at outpatients, you know, 3 months after they recovered, they were pretty much back to normal. That wasn't everyone's story. There was obviously lots of people who, you know, did have a very protracted recovery. And then there were other people, you know, who maybe hadn't been as severely affected whilst they were in hospital, but had a much, much more difficult trajectory in the recovery phase. So basically, we sort of adapted our research to look at that. And that study sort of reached a natural conclusion that we're just about to publish. And I guess our work with Nigel is sort of the next step, where now what we're looking at is we're focusing on long COVID, and we're just about to start recruiting patients to a new study that basically will follow those patients with long COVID up over a course of 2 years. And we'll be looking at their immune system changes and how that correlates to how their symptoms change. So much like sort of hearing the story at the beginning about how many years it can take to recover from COVID-19, the idea is if we catch people while they're symptomatic now and sort of see what changes as they get better, it might give us a better idea of what, I guess, how we can sort of track the natural trajectory of long COVID and, you know, identify things that we might be able to change to make things better for people.
And I guess what's cool about that original study, and if you want to give me a link to that, I can drop it in the show notes as well, is that you have that data right from the start. Because I think what a lot of studies, and I suppose what your second study is going to be doing, is picking up people sort of longer along the road. So, you know, the COVID infection is in the past. They've done the whole thing where they thought they were getting better and then they weren't getting better. And then maybe they were getting, oh no, but then they weren't. And that kind of start of the wiggle of long COVID. And then they start tracking their symptoms and they start logging things, because that's kind of what you do. But your original study had that data right from the start, whether they ended up having long COVID or not. So I suppose that's very cool.
Yeah, so it was interesting. I guess as ever with research, is when you look back at it, there's always that inclination to think, well, what didn't we have for that study as well? So I think that the major question which is running through our minds, but we haven't really had a way of answering as well, is a step before that, is that we've seen some changes, I guess, in people who've ended up with long COVID. But were those people, before they had infections, were they different in some way? So, you know, before the pandemic came around, were they almost predetermined, I guess, that those people were going to end up with long COVID? And all that they were looking for was the right sort of stimulus, if you like, which happened to be the COVID-19 illness. So, yeah, so I guess in short, it has been really helpful to track, you know, all the way from acute infection to recovery. But I guess there's also some unanswered questions that I guess we have ideas that we want to sort of put into practice in the future. But, yeah, I guess we haven't, you know, all of this is sort of an ongoing piece of work, I guess.
And I guess that's the thing with research, isn't it? You know, you find thing and then you get an answer, and then, you know, that just leads to more questions, which then gives you more answers, which then leads to more questions. So it's like the more you know, what is it, the thing that the more you know, the more you realize you don't know? Is that the saying, or did I just make that up? It's something like that, isn't it?
But it certainly feels like that.
It's a complicated business, you know, when you think about the adaptive immune system and the interplay in different indications. That now, the interesting thing around viruses or even oncology, because again, I come from an oncology background as well. You know, what viruses do very well as oncology, they adapt the microenvironment, they adapt the, you know, they want to keep growing. So they turn things on and they turn things off to allow them to grow. And the and in this instance, you know, and where we're coming at it, you know, with respect to the T cells, and in particular T cell exhaustion or T cell dysfunction, it's a term that's been about in oncology for many years. So you can imagine most of the immunology compounds, the big sort of sellers like pembrolizumab and stuff and things like that, that's what they're doing. They're targeting receptors that cause T cell exhaustion, and they're the same receptors that cause the T cell exhaustion in viral syndromes. So to the point why some people get a long COVID or an ME, it could be that you've been exposed to certain viruses in the past, like Epstein-Barr or you know, CMV or herpes, and that's SARS-CoV, even though it might not be a really bad episode of, is enough to tip the balance, and it's enough to bring on this T cell exhaustion. And in doing so, you know, the symptoms sort of come from that, which is super. I mean, it's very interesting, but as you said, it's very complicated as well. And a lot of the research that's been done, because there's been an awful lot of long COVID studies that have been conducted, and the data's just starting to come out on that. I think that we're trying to be in a situation that we can react to that data, but also provide meaningful tests. Because as you know, there is no diagnosis for long COVID. It's self-diagnosis, or there's a questionnaire. And I think what we would like to do through the research, you know, with Sean within the respiratory study that he's doing, as well as the other work that we're doing, is to hopefully provide, you know, tests that actually help with that early diagnosis of that in relation to that T cell dysfunction or T cell exhaustion.
Yeah, so it could be the sort of the straw that breaks the camel's back sort of thing, you know, a collection of viruses over time, and then boom, COVID happens to be the one.
Yeah.
I suppose the question, I mean, I'm going off on a tangent here, which is totally not like me, but why is it COVID for so many people? Is it just the sheer volume of infections all at once that, you know, there were a lot of people that were kind of primed for it, so to speak? Or was there something special about that particular virus that added a particular load on that made so many people kind of topple over into this kind of state?
Yeah, well, I guess you could both pick that up and probably give you slightly different variations on maybe a similar theme. But I guess my impression of it is that I guess the first few waves of the pandemic, where sort of before we had a vaccination and before the Omicron variant sort of emerged, the syndrome of, at least in hospital, of the patients we were seeing was quite different, I guess, to what we usually see with a lot of other respiratory viral infections. And the main difference really was the amount of inflammatory load and damage within the lungs. And I guess in terms of the tools that we have to look at that in the hospital, it's basically what you can see on a chest X-ray. And even so from our study and others like it, almost all the patients that came in, regardless of the severity of their infection, had some visible changes on their chest X-ray, meaning that they had inflammation to a degree that there was, you know, collections of fluid within the lungs that we usually wouldn't see. So, you know, with viruses, I guess they commonly come in the winter periods, like influenza and respiratory syncytial virus. Usually with those, there's only a very small portion of patients where we see those changes. But yeah, those changes were just a lot more widespread. And of course, then there was the numbers of people coming in. So what still puzzles me now is in the first wave, how we stopped seeing everything else for a while in the hospital. So all the other presentations that we normally see you know, people coming with heart attacks and stroke. Everything just seemed to stop, and we just got COVID for a while. So I think to answer your question, I think it was sort of a new virus with perhaps very little residual immunity in the population. And what that means is that the way that our immune systems handled that virus was probably quite different to how it usually would handle other viruses that it's more familiar with. And that maybe led to sort of more damage within the lungs. And I guess leading on from that, it could be that as a result of that damage and the longer process to heal that damage, that that sort of changes the immune system and lots of other systems in the body as well in a certain way that gives someone a protracted recovery.
Yeah, and just moving on from that, and with that damage that Sean had mentioned, you know, and when you get that acute inflammatory response, what you do get is you get a lot of oxidative stress on the actual system. And oxidative stress, we'll know all about things like reactive oxygen species, because that's the sort of thing that ages us. But it's also, you know, when we have an inflammatory response, there is quite a lot of reactive oxygen species that's generated. And the oxidative stress itself is a balance between high ROS, as they call it, and the antioxidant sort of proteins that keep it in balance. And with that, you know, when you have high levels of oxidative stress, it does actually have an effect on the adaptive immunity as well as the cellular microenvironment. So to that point, it actually gets to the point where your adaptive immune system is not working properly. But also, and we'll most probably get onto this because, you know, around the commonality around the symptoms of something like long COVID and something like ME, that's been about for an awful long time sort of thing, about that effect or that downstream effect on something like the mitochondria, which is the mainstay of the energy, you know, that supplies you sort of thing, and whatever you're on, the effect on that. So it's not a simple thing. And I think what we're trying to do here with the research within this study and in general is to try and understand, is there some sort of signature from your T cells? And your T cells are things that are there to sort of help kill the virus as part of your adaptive immune. Is there some sort of signature that you can actually look to see that, you know, you've got either that early diagnosis or you've got this T cell exhaustion? And is there anything that you can do, whether that's a dietary thing or whether it's antioxidants or whether there's some treatment that's coming up, that you can actually have that intervention to help prevent getting to the stage where maybe your adaptive immune system rewires itself into a different sort of stage? And that's, I think, where we would like to sort of come at it from.
If I could just come in on that as well, because I think it's probably useful to kind of also discuss at the moment how, I guess up until now, we've been talking about long COVID like it's one sort of thing. But the other thing to mention is that I guess we still don't really know 100% what long COVID is. And in truth, it's probably a couple of different things coexisting in the same space. And the reason I think that's important to say is I think one of the reasons I was really keen to work with Nigel and how sort of collaboration came about was it would be really helpful for us to have some diagnostic tests to maybe identify particular people who may be having a problem with their immune system in long COVID, which may be different from other people who may be having different problems. And, you know, there's lots of things that happened in the pandemic. We've spoken about how the virus was different and how that sort of maybe changed the inflammation that people would have had compared to other viruses that we're more familiar with. But on top of that, there were all the other changes that happened around the pandemic in terms of the lockdowns and the changes in social situations and all of that. And all of those things would have impacted people as well. You know, so it's, I guess to put it this way, there probably is a subset of people who have an issue with their immune system that's sort of changed as a result of SARS-CoV-2 infection. But then there may be other people who've had other things that have happened as well. And I think at this stage where we've just got one sort of amorphous blob that we're calling long COVID, it's really important to try and tease those things apart and try and identify patients who maybe have an actionable thing that we can do to help them along the way.
We'll be right back. I'm interrupting myself for a second to tell you about long COVID breathing. The fabulous Vicky Jones and I have teamed up to bring you long COVID breathing. We are both passionate about sharing our expertise and experience of the breath and how incredibly helpful that can be with long COVID. We've worked together to develop a course that is specifically tailored to those with long COVID. It's a 6-week course with 12 sessions, all delivered online. The community feel and learning that we're all sharing is such a joy. To find out more information and to sign up for our courses, workshops and other shorter sessions, please check out the link below, longcovidbreathing.com, or email longcovidbreathing@gmail.com to start your breathing journey with us. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good point. This sort of underlying cause, sort of holy grail, isn't it, almost? What is that? I think what might be really useful, I think, Nigel, you've mentioned T cells a couple of times now. Would it be okay to just take a dip into sort of science lessons? Can you tell us what are T cells and why are they relevant?
When you talk about the immune system, you talk about the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system. So usually when you're exposed to some sort of virus, the innate system kicks in and we talk about white cells and we've got lymphocytes and macrophages. So what they do is they basically mop up things that they can do. They create these antigens that then basically, you know, the adaptive immune system utilizes, because it recognizes these antigens. Now, when we talk about the adaptive immune system, we talk about B cells and T cells. Now, B cells tend to generate antibodies sort of against that neutralize, but also stimulate cytokines for the T cells. Now, the T cells I'd mentioned to you before are really sort of killer cells. So they're basically used, you know, to actually kill that virus. So what happens is when your body can't deal with the initial virus, then it'll kick the adaptive immune system in to deal with that. Now, usually with an infection, you know, a lot of people tend to get a fever and stuff like that 48 hours later. And that's because that inflammatory part is kicked in and it starts to kill those specific, that virus or that pathogen and whatever. So when we talk about the T cells, we're talking about, you know, helper cells, and there's regulatory cells and there's memory cells. So if you remember sometimes, and this is the whole thing around the vaccination, is that you're vaccinated and then when you get exposed later on, you have these memory T cells that they can really target. It's more of a targeted effect on the actual immune system. So that's what we're talking about. So usually what happens, you know, when somebody's exposed to a virus, the T cells do a good job and the immune system does a good job of getting rid of that. Now, in some instances, the body just can't do that. Now, that could be because it's been exposed to some previous virus and because it doesn't want to remove it, because in removing it, it's going to have to then attack its own tissues. So in many instances, what will happen is, and this is where this thought around the exhausted T cell is, the T cell is not efficiently working in doing what it's supposed to do. And it's what it's doing is it's keeping at a level that will keep it at bay, but it won't actually get rid of it. So maybe when you're exposed to something else, then it tips it over the edge. And that's what we're potentially sort of talking about here when we talk about that T cell exhaustion or that inefficiency of the adaptive immune system to get rid of that virus. So it means that you've got this antigen presentation, which is just present. And in doing so, you've got that more chronic inflammation. And with that chronic inflammation can have repercussions on the cellular microenvironment. And that also includes something like oxidative stress that we talked about. And then when you think about that, how would that then affect something like a symptom like chronic fatigue or some of the symptoms that we've seen? Well, that can cause dysfunction in the likes of the mitochondria. And as we mentioned before, something like that, because it's 90-95% of the energy, you know, that we require comes from there, you can then imagine it manifests itself in some sort of, potentially in some sort of symptoms. Now, do we understand that, you know, that T cell exhaustion or that oxidative stress with the symptoms of chronic fatigue, with brain fog and stuff? Not 100%, but certainly there's definitely links there. And I think, you know, T cell dysfunction and the link to mitochondrial dysfunction and some of the symptoms that we see in these post-viral syndromes, including, you know, long COVID, you know, I think they're quite present and quite relevant to specifically look at.
Yeah, and does this play into the sort of biopersistence theory then? So you say if the T cells aren't working as well as they should, they might be sort of knocking it down, keeping it at bay a little bit, but not properly eradicating it. So this is why some people clear the virus and some people don't.
Exactly. I mean, if you think about if you're exposed to the virus, you get this fever maybe 48 hours later, it's because you've created this, there's an awful lot of inflammation. And that inflammation is caused by the T cells killing the virus and stuff like that. If, for instance, it's not functioning that properly, you're not necessarily going to get that same clearance of the actual virus. So again, when something else comes up, then it becomes a problem because you've just got this persistence of a chronic inflammation. And wherever you're in that chronic inflammation is then manifesting itself in some downstream things on targets that might actually produce some immunocompromised environment. So in oncology, they talk about a tumor microenvironment, which is immunosuppressed, and it could be a similar type of thing, not in the tumor, but certainly within the cellular environment.
And I guess the other thing to say with that is even if eventually your T cells did clear the virus, so let's say that you had that process that Nigel was outlining there, and that process took a little bit longer than it would to sort of clear, say, influenza or another virus that maybe we're more familiar with. What can happen then, which happens to lots of people, is actually it's surprising how much function you can lose from being inactive for a short period of time. So if you have a protracted illness, even if you've cleared the virus and, your immune system, if you like, has gone back to normal, but if that process has taken too long, then there's lots of changes in your body that we call deconditioning, meaning that your muscles are less able to, control how you walk around and those sorts of things, your energy levels are lower. Then that can sometimes also lead to people getting into a negative loop. So it might be that actually you started with an immunological problem that's since resolved, but then you're left with sort of the functional deficit, if you like, that having a protracted illness has caused. So that's another thing that can kind of factor into long COVID, which I think does make it more complex, because I guess you've got all these bits that are kind of meant to work together. That, and if one thing isn't quite working, then sometimes you can have effects sort of beyond that. Beyond that organ, beyond that sort of system within the body.
So just sort of building on that, and then go back to this sort of oncology point of view. When we talk about PD-1, PD-1's a big thing, and targets like sort of PIGID and stuff. They're all targets that a lot of oncology immunological drugs target. Now, to the point what Sean was sort of saying, say for instance you have that initial sort of insult of, say, something like SARS-CoV, those expression levels are increased, and in when you increase the PD-1 levels, whether it's in a tumor or within the actual sort of system, then what it's actually going to do is actually going to have an effect on these cytotoxic T cells. Either not going to be able to do that. So the question is once that virus is gone, do the expression levels of PD-1 and those receptors that are known to basically affect T-cell, do they go back to a normal state, or do they stay within that expression level and they don't go down? And because of that, then you're going to have this general problem moving forward. And that's certainly something, that we would want to specifically look at. Now, of course, to use your immunology drugs and stuff and something like, viruses and stuff like that can be a wee bit extreme, because obviously of the side effects associated with that. But there's certainly something, that we could potentially look at in between. And certainly I know that there's lots of cytokines that are associated with long COVID, and there's also cytokines that are associated with exhausted T cells. And there's certain things that we can do without necessarily taking specific, drugs to potentially sort of, alleviate that to a certain extent. But I think when we think about, developing, a diagnostic, of course we want to catch the diagnosis early, because the later we catch it, the chances are it might take longer to get back to sort of a normal state. But what we also want to do is to provide, insightful research to developers and drug companies who are actually developing therapies to target those specific, whether it be a cytokine or whether it be a specific receptor that's upregulated.
Yeah. This is fascinating. Now, you just touched on that sort of diagnosis. And I think one of the sort of many frustrations of long COVID, I was going to say the main, and I'm not sure that's true because there are so many. But one thing that is very difficult is that it's a clinical diagnosis. There's no biomarker. You don't go to your doctor and get a blood test and they're like, aha, you have long COVID. It's not that simple. And nowadays, so few people are actually taking tests that actually, people who might be developing long COVID sort of on from now may not even know that they've had COVID to start with. So I suppose this is where things like this come really useful. Partly, we shouldn't need to have some sort of diagnosis, some sort of test in order for people to believe that you have symptoms. But unfortunately, that is the case in some circumstances that you will not be believed unless you actually have that kind of that test and a bit of paper. But also, maybe more importantly, that actually, in order to make that diagnosis, having a test that you can do where you can say sort of without any doubt, yes, this is long COVID, or yes, this is a post-viral condition, it will help to rule out other things as well, I suppose, because what the process at the moment is, it's a diagnosis of exclusion, isn't it? You go and get tested for literally everything else under the sun. And, it's only once all of that has come back negative that then it's like, oh, well, it's the only thing left kind of thing. So, yeah, how does this work, I suppose?
Perhaps if I come in just from the clinical angle on that, is I think one of the things that's different maybe about having an immunological test is that it's a bit different to just saying like yes or no, you have a condition, in the sense that what we would be defining is an immunological state. And where that's different is that it kind of gives you some insight into what might be going on inside that patient. So they've come in with some symptoms, they've said, I've got fatigue, brain fog, and all of those sorts of things. And then this blood test would say, yes, so I guess you've got all of those things going on, and we can see that your immune cells are doing this, which is perhaps different to what we might be expecting. And that kind of, so although at the moment, I guess when you're thinking of anything that might develop into a clinical intervention, it takes many, many years to go all the way from your idea to kind of actually having, something that's very protocolized and delivered in the NHS and in guidelines and all the rest of it. But I guess this does put you on a path in that you can start to see how things are going wrong, and you can start to think about interventions that might be able to influence that test. So it's a bit different to like a test. I'm trying to think of an example. Well, say if you were having a test to see if you had cancer or not, and you had a scan and they said yes, you've got cancer, or no, you don't have cancer. It doesn't tell you how to treat the cancer. It just says it's there or not. So that I guess that's where this test is maybe a bit different to just having a sort of a yes or no answer.
And as you mentioned, Jackie, currently people are usually diagnosed based on a questionnaire, and based on your score, you would get diagnosed on that. So looking forward, and as we were looking to develop a T cell diagnostic, and what we'd be looking at, as part of that, we would be looking at specific cytokines that we would start with certainly the known suspects. So, if you look at the literature, people who have long COVID seem to have lower levels of cytokines, IL-2 and TNF-alpha, interferon gamma. So there's things that are sort of known about. However, there are other cytokines that are super important specifically to that. And understanding, because it could be a number of different things that are causing these things, because you mentioned this whole thing, how do you know it's specifically SARS-CoV and it's not something like Epstein-Barr or something like some other viral type of thing. So I think when we are thinking about developing this, and we are developing this sort of a T cell diagnostic, you can come at it from a couple of points of view. You can come at it about, an antigen related to the specific sort of a variant of SARS-CoV, or you can look at how the actual, virus itself is broken, the epitopes, and you can actually have a specific epitope mix which is specific for that virus, which when it placed with your blood cells or your PBMCs, as we would call it, your intracell, it will actually activate the T cells specific to that virus. So as Sean was saying, that what you would then get is a specific phenotype, which is associated specifically with that virus. Now, if you provide a test, and we'll go back to this questionnaire thing, because the only thing that's potentially available is that you've got this questionnaire, which is approved and is used by clinicians, you know, based on symptoms associated with long COVID, which are very similar to a lot of other post-viral syndromes. But and then you've got a test which is specific to that virus, then you can use that phenotype, you know, especially if you do that association with the symptoms and the actual signature, that you can then utilize that moving forward about, you know, right, we have a diagnosis of long COVID associated with now T-cell dysfunction or T-cell exhaustion. Because as Sean was saying, there's many different symptoms. And to think that you can come up with one test that will answer all of the things, I think where we're coming at it is we believe that the adaptive immune system has got a central role and a potential signature that can help guide around that that early diagnosis. And I think the early diagnosis is super important because, yes, people have been and are living with long COVID and have been for a while, but SARS-CoV hasn't gone away. And vaccinations are most probably not gone away either, sort of thing. So people will be exposed to SARS-CoV in the future. It could be a slightly different variant and whatever, you know. So there is the potential that you're going to get new people and whatever, you know, who are going to get these symptoms. And the question is if you can identify early, you can maybe actually have an intervention or some sort of treatment management to help with the long COVID symptoms. But you could also potentially pinpoint a level at where, you know, you don't really want to go on before it affects the actual adaptive immune and it prevents it from rewiring into a different sort of stage sort of thing. And I think that's where we see the value in such a test. And as you mentioned, you know, if you have something like a, you know, some peptide mix, which is specific to the virus, you can do the same things for other post-viral syndromes, say like Lyme disease or cytomegalovirus or Epstein-Barr or something like that, or influenza sort of thing. So again, you can provide that sort of information because the biggest problem, and people with ME have been living with this for 40, 50 years about this, have been not being diagnosed and not being believed. You know, it's good that all of this research has been done in long COVID. You know, people who, and I know many people. So I think it's crucial, as you say, to get that early diagnosis or get a diagnosis of that actual problem.
Yeah. And as you say, you know, post-viral stuff is not just long COVID. It's been around for much, much longer. I suppose what would be interesting, and I don't know if there's something you even know yet, you know, these immune responses, these T cell exhaustion that you're looking to be able to test for, does this look the same in long COVID as it does in people with, say, ME/CFS, with Lyme, with any of these others? You know, are you seeing commonalities across there?
That's exactly what we see, is the combination of cytokines. Like I'd mentioned, you know, IL-2 and TNF-alpha. Is that the same as it would be for Lyme disease, you know, or ME? Or is it slightly different? Because if it is the same, and when we think it, let's just say in a general term, you've got T-cell exhaustion. And that T-cell exhaustion is having an effect on glycolysis through its effect in the mitochondria, which is having a problem around the energy, general energy production, which could be causing symptoms of chronic fatigue and whatever, you know. Is there a commonality? Now, if there is a commonality, it may well be, we will find that out. But ultimately, you know, the test itself, although the virus might be slightly different and whatever, you know, the result will most probably be the same. And that's certainly something that we would specifically look at. So if I was looking in the future, you know, could you get to the point where you would have a 96-well plate, different peptide mixes, you know, for the different viral syndromes, but with the ultimate same sort of cytokines which are associated with that T-cell exhaustion, which, you know, were obviously linked in some way sort of thing to that sort of chronic fatigue. That would be the way to go. So you would go to the GP and they would test you for the different sort of, and then you would do that. The interesting thing about the peptide mix that's specific to that virus, the question is when you're using that to stimulate the T cells? Is that stimulation and the release of the cytokines, is it different? And we don't know yet, but we will find out.
And I guess this kind of takes us into the research that brought you guys together, and indeed all of us here today together. So this is an extension or a kind of relaunch, the next bit, I suppose, of the research that you described at the start, Sean. So maybe I just kind of throw it out there and say, tell us about the research. We'll be right back.
Hey there, I'm just jumping in for a second to see if you're enjoying this episode. If you're finding it useful, maybe you would consider sharing it somewhere, a friend, a group, or even on your Twitter feed. If everyone was able to share just once, we'd be able to get this information out to even more people who really, really need it. So please consider sharing somewhere if you possibly can. I hope you enjoy the episode, and thank you so much.
Yeah, I guess like we've been saying throughout, so this study for us is sort of like the second phase of things, in that we, I guess the first study was that we did right at the beginning of the pandemic, ended up being called the Serco study, which was just to emphasize, it was sort of a Greater Manchester collaboration, and there were lots and lots of people involved in that. And one of the things that we found, which we've sort of published in part along the way, and like I was just saying, our current paper is currently just being put together, is that there were some specific phenotypes that seemed to drop out in patients with long COVID. And some of those, so there is a story of T-cell exhaustion, which we've spoken about quite a lot today, but there were also some changes in the B-cells that we saw as well. So Nigel was mentioning the B-cells are the cells that make the antibodies, if you like. And we did see that there were some differences in terms of how the B-cells in patients with long COVID, I guess, generally sort of produce their antibodies. So what we looked at was all the B-cells, because what's quite extraordinary about the adaptive immune system is the extraordinary variation that you have in the B cell and T cell genetic makeup. Because maybe if we dive back a little bit into some science, I guess when you're growing up at school, you're kind of told that you have the same code of DNA in all of your cells. But what's really is that doesn't really hold true when you get into the adaptive immune system, because what happens is that your T cells and your B cells randomly mutate bits of your DNA. So that gives them all a slightly different genetic makeup that enables them to detect things that you haven't even seen yet. So if you like, you would have had from early on, you know, all of us would have had some T cells that were sort of born to recognize SARS-CoV-2, even though we hadn't seen it yet. And, you know, it hadn't sort of emerged as a, certainly as a pandemic. So within that, we can see that in our patients with long COVID, the way that those B cells refine their specificity to being able to recognize COVID is slightly different to patients who've made a full recovery. So I guess one thing that we want to do alongside the work with the T cell exhaustion is to look at that process as well, again, in a longitudinal sense. So the idea is that you recruit, we would ask people with long COVID to take part, and enough people to get some variation in that. So we'd get some people who had maybe very disordered sort of B cell, what we call affinity maturation, where you get the B cells sort of becoming more specific, I guess, to the target that they're sort of trying to protect against. So we would get sort of a range of people who sort of have a very good response, say, and those who don't have a good response, and then seeing how those change over time, how that correlates with symptoms. And I guess the expectation is that everyone will get illnesses like we all do across each winter period. So over that 2 years, we'll be able to see what sort of infections people are getting and how they're responding to those as well. So it's maybe slightly more refined in that we have more data than we did when we started our first COVID-19 study, but it is still fairly broad in that there's still lots that we don't understand. And like we've been saying throughout this, I guess, there's lots of work that we need to do to really understand what long COVID is. So this is sort of part of that work is to try and maybe get closer to that sort of question.
And I totally agree with what Sean was saying, is that, you know, there's tests out there that measure cytokines. And certainly for many years, the go-to test, and I would imagine in a lot of the long COVID studies that were done previously, they use ELISA. And you can have a panel of, 60 cytokines and look at the cytokines. But the problem with something like ELISA is you don't know the origin of that. So what Sean's talking about is the origin CD4, is it CD8 cells? Because again, that will give you some sort of guidance if it's coming from B or T cells and stuff and things like that. Is it dendritic? Now, unlike us working with something like serum or plasma, what we would be doing is we would be, you know, separating out the PBMCs, or the peripheral bloods, which has got the intracellular components of that. So, you know, although we'd be measuring, you know, the cytokine release, we would also be looking at the origin of that. You know, is it coming from a B or is it T cell, a dendritic cell? Because again, we really do want to try and understand a little bit more around the adaptive immune system. And I know that, you know, as part of the collaboration that we've got with Sean in the group, is that we even want to go a little bit further in that, you know, to look at all of that, that those origins, look at the type of cells and the changes within those cells over time with these longitudinal samples. So although the research, I think when you do these things, certainly when you're talking about the adaptive immune system, you're talking about getting some sort of in vitro diagnostic out there. With drug development, with anything, it's super important that when you develop that diagnostic, that the science behind it is something that people and clinicians, GPs who are going to be utilizing that, understand the value of that. And so, you know, for us to publish and move the science on is super important, just as important as developing the actual in vitro diagnostic. So although, you know, this is a 2-year study where we're going to be sort of looking at that, and we'll be, you know, also hopefully in moving the science on and the understanding on, what we will be doing is we will be looking to get, you know, to develop the in vitro diagnostic, you know, most probably in conjunction with a questionnaire initially, where we're looking at a signature, and we'll be going for full approval. And when we go for full approval, CE marking, IVD approval, you know, we'll be working alongside the MHRA or even in the US, the FDA, and hopefully partnering with them. So when you think about when you're developing an IVD, you have to have a clinical validation study. You validate what it's supposed to do. We would look right from the beginning to have those early discussions with the regulatory authorities to define what those outcomes are within the clinical study, which would be, you know, insightful and have utility with respect to that early diagnosis. And that's the sort of journey that we would do. So the research and the work and the samples that we can generate from this study, we will use to develop that assay and understand that more. But ultimately, as we see that development of the IVD and long COVID, and whatever, you know, also potentially in other post-viral syndromes, say, like Lyme disease, if we said, that's what we would want to do. Because with a full IVD approval to CE mark, you can make a clinical decision. And unless you actually have that, and it's, you know, the analytical performance and the clinical performance is done, you can't inject that into that healthcare provider journey. So the ultimate goal for us is to get a fully approved regulatory diagnostic, which is approved by the likes of, say, NICE, or at least we've involved them in the early journey, that it can actually be put into the healthcare system to help with that diagnosis, rather than, oh, I have this test, how do I get it to GPs?
Yeah. And I suppose this comes back to the idea of, like, you know, diagnosis is kind of the first step in actually getting something that helps, whether that's pharmaceutical or more holistic or whatever that looks like. You've got to understand what you're dealing with before you have any idea how to tackle it. But at the same time, a diagnostic is only useful if it actually leads to a pathway. So I suppose that is the next step, isn't it? Okay, we've got this diagnosis. We now know what's going wrong. All right, so what do we actually do about that?
We talked early around antioxidants and oxidative stress. So to your point, you know, there are things that potentially we could do to reduce that oxidative stress, because we know that oxidative stress in general is not a good thing, or chronic inflammation unless you're trying to get rid of a pathogen, is most probably not a good thing. So again, to identify even a signature to say that, you know, actually you've got quite a high level of chronic inflammation and whatever, you know, that signature, you know, of the cytokines, it's most probably related to some sort of post-viral syndrome, like something like SARS-CoV or long COVID and stuff. And there's something that you could potentially do something about that to reduce the potential symptoms, because you're reducing that oxidative stress, and then you're, and in doing so, you're most probably helping with that energy thing with respect to the mitochondrial dysfunction that a lot of these syndromes specifically have. So even though if there's not any drugs specifically available at this moment in time, I think the information that such a test would do, it would help guide research and development about potential therapeutic interventions later on.
Great. Well, thank you so much for giving up your time to speak to me this afternoon. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing about all of this, and that you're working together to do this. It's amazing. So the study that you've mentioned, and the study that is going to be launching, I'll make sure that links to that go into the show notes. So if there's anybody interested in that, then they can absolutely follow that up. So thank you so much. Good luck. And maybe you'll come back and talk to me once you have some results.
Yeah, no, we'd love to do that.
Thank you so much to all of my guests and to you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it, or at least found it useful. The Long COVID podcast is entirely self-produced and self-funded. I'm doing all of this myself. If you're able to, please go to buymeacoffee.com/longcovidpod to help me cover the costs of hosting the podcast. Please look out for the next episode of the Long COVID podcast. It's available on all the usual podcast hosting things. And do get in touch. I'd love to hear from you.